So the delayed one comes, again, in two different flavors, in my eyes. First of all, the delayed or more chronic cumulative neurotoxicity is clearly associated with the cumulative dose administered in oxaplan. So we almost see a kind of a threshold effect. When patients go beyond 600, 650 milligrams per meter squared, neurotoxicity really takes off. And the scary thing is that sometimes the kind of peak of neurotoxicity can actually lag behind the actual administration of oxaplan.
This is a more typical peripheral neuropathy.
It's a typical peripheral neuropathy, which can be numbness, can, however, also be painful in rare situations, dysesthesias, paresthesias, affecting hands and feet. And we just recently talked about some patterns in terms of how feet and hand sensory neuropathy evolves over time, that the immediate problem is more in the hands and that the delayed, perhaps more chronified, toxicity in terms of nerval impairment is more related to the feet for whatever reasons. But again, there is this phenomenon when you stop patients on oxaplan, the neurotoxicity in a lot of patients gets worse for some time before it gets better. And sometimes patients are concerned about that more than anything else because we tell them, you know, when we stop oxaplan, it should get better. But it actually gets worse for some time before it gets better.
Of course, we have a lot more understanding of this since the trials have been done. Yeah. And people, I think, are much more conservative, much more open to stopping the oxaliplatin if they see these kinds of problems. When you do that, when you take that type of aggressive approach, for example, the way your own practice does, how often do you see somebody who 2-3 years later really has a problem that bothers them?
It's an interesting phenomenon when you talk about neurotoxicity because even in these chronic neurotoxicities, patients adjust. Patients learn, for instance, to watch their hands when they do things, something you and I take for granted when we tie our shoelaces, when we button our shirts. We don't have visual control of what we're doing because we know what we're doing with our hands. Patients adjust to the point that they observe what they're doing and visually kind of monitor their function. So patients learn how to work around that. So I have very few patients who after 2 or 3 years tell me, you know, this is still affecting my activities of daily living or my quality of life. But if you ask them closely or you let them kind of answer questionnaires, there's a substantial number of patients that still report some form of nerve impairment to their feet, to their hands, after 2 or 3 years, even off oxaplan.
Now again, 2-3 years later, is that mainly sensory or do you actually see motor problems?
Sensory. Motor problems only indirectly as a lack of tactile function.
You know, it's interesting, you know, chemotherapy, particularly I think from the perception of people outside of medical oncology, for example, surgeons that this program is targeting, certainly doesn't have a very positive reputation. But, you know, when you think about FOLFOX, which is right now the most common adjuvant regimen, and you compare it to just AC, even without a taxane in breast cancer, AC, complete alopecia, pretty often that you see GI problems, cardiomyopathy in a few patients, leukemia occasionally.
Agreed.
You know, FOLFOX kind of seems not, you know, when you get back to this issue of using it in the higher risk stage 2 patient, I don't see that kind of problems with FOLFOX.
No. I mean, that's why I default toward more treating patient than not treating patient if there's one risk factor that I'm aware of. Very clear. When I talk to patients about, you know, the initial patient contact, which can be very long, we talk about chemotherapy. And it's interesting. The first statement that I make to patients when I talk about side effects, I tell them what they should not expect. The first point I always make, this is interesting, talking about with my colleagues today was, when I talk to my patients, I say, you will not lose your hair. And this is the first statement. I see a visual relief on the faces of a lot of patients because they can sit back in this adjuvant or even palliative setting and convey the impression that they are still healthy, that they are not affected by anything to the outer world, to themselves. They don't change the image. You know, it's debatable how important hair loss is for quality of life, and it's very difficult to measure that. But I can see almost every patient that I talk to in this manner saying, hey, when we talk about side effects, let me first tell you what you won't have. You will not have irrelevant alopecia. They are relieved.
You know, it's interesting. A lot of people sort of poo-poo hair loss. And, you know, obviously it's not going to threaten anybody's life. And in the adjuvant setting, it's temporary. But yet, I hear a lot of people talking about how disturbing an experience that is. They're already facing the shock of their life and being diagnosed with cancer.
Yeah, and I mean, this will become even more important, let's say, if we have clinical data that would allow us or would encourage us to use cetuximab in the adjuvant setting.
So Erbitux, where you see the skin reaction.
Where you see a skin rash,
right.
Exactly. And, you know, this is a very visual recognition about, okay, you're on therapy right now. Because a patient with, let's say, 50, 60 years old suddenly gets an acne-like rash. It's a very, very kind of stigmatizing factor that patients suddenly experience.